study led you to this conclusion. Thank you. Anon. Answer. There is some degree of immunity after natural COVID-19 infection for at least the first 3 months after infection. After that, immunity begins to wane. In the large study for the Pfizer vaccine, longer-term immunity was evaluated by comparing the risk of acquiring COVID-19 in the group that did not receive vaccine between those who had antibodies showing previous infection against those who did not. The attack rate, the proportion infected by COVID-19, was 1.3% in people with and without COVID-19 antibodies at baseline. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach. Roach's column appears Tuesdays through Saturdays. Readers may write him at P.O. Box 536475, Orlando, Florida, 32853-6475.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 55 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 10 a.m.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome. This is Independent Living, and I'm your reader, Leslie, with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from several health newsletters. The first one is from Tufts University Health and Nutrition Letter. And this first article is titled, Lose Weight and Keep It Off. Our board of experts weighs in with the latest on what works for weight loss and for preventing weight regain. Weight is about more than appearance. Being overweight and obese is associated with a lower quality of life, especially as we age, and higher risk for a wide range of diseases, from diabetes and cardiovascular disease to cancer and viral infections. The good news is losing even 5 to 10% of excess weight can have a dramatic impact on health. But what is the best way to lose weight, and how do we get it to stay off? Tufts University is home to the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy, one of the world's leading nutrition graduate programs, as well as the Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging, where researchers study the intersection of diet and health every day. Here, the stellar researchers and professors who serve on the advisory board of this newsletter offer their up-to-minute expert advice on achieving and maintaining a healthy weight. So the first category, cutting calories, preventing regain. And this is by Jean Goldberg, PhD. She's an advisory board member and professor emerita of nutrition interventions, communications, and behavior change at the Friedman School. Dr. Goldberg has worked on obesity and chronic disease prevention interventions since 1995. She says, if there were a magic bullet for losing weight and keeping it off, we'd all be at our ideal weight. At the end of the day, it is the ratio of calories in to calories out that determines weight loss. There is no shortage of literature guaranteeing success to anyone who follows the you-fill-in-the-blank diet. Some of these diets are well-balanced and sensible. Others lack those healthful substitutes. Some are downright extreme. But history has shown if the user burns more calories than they consume, they will lose weight. The critical question is what happens after the weight is lost. While not perfect, a project called the National Weight Registry provided some valuable guidance on maintenance of weight loss. Behaviors associated with successful maintenance included regular weighing, careful monitoring of the amount of food consumed, and regular physical activity, quite a bit of it, as much as 2.5 hours a day. In fact, while it is unlikely that exercise itself without restricting caloric intake will lead to weight loss, exercise is critical to maintaining weight loss. The next expert to weigh in is editor-in-chief of the Tufts Health and Nutrition Letter, Darius Mazafarian. He's MD and Dr. PH. He's also dean of the Friedman School. He has authored more than 400 scientific publications on dietary priorities for obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. And he writes, for long-term success, focus on overall food quality. Rather than specific nutrients or counting total calories, one priority is to eliminate fast-carb foods rich in refined grains, starches, and sugars. Foods like white bread, rice, most crackers, salty snacks, and granola bars, as well as sugary foods like soda, energy drinks, store-sweetened teas and coffees, and candy, which have low nutritional quality. In their place, eat minimally processed phytonutrient-rich foods like fruits, nuts, seeds, beans, veggies, plant oils, plain yogurt, and fish. Chicken and eggs are fine on occasion, and unprocessed red meat once or twice per week. Higher intakes of healthy fats from plants and plant oils are helpful, too. This next expert is Nicola McCowan, Ph.D. She's an associate professor of the Friedman School and a scientist in the nutritional epidemiology team at the HNRCA. Dr. McCowan is internationally renowned for her research examining the role of whole grains in promoting health. And she writes, for most people, trying to control hunger between meals is a challenge. Naturally fiber-rich plant-based foods such as fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and beans are high-quality choices that can actually help control hunger. Fiber slows food intake, stomach emptying, and intestinal transit time, all of which help keep you feeling full and satisfied. So make sure you eat naturally fiber-rich foods throughout the day. This next expert is Robin Kanarek, Ph.D. She is the John Wade Professor of Psychology Emerita at the Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Dr. Kanarek's career has focused on the behavioral neuroscience of nutrition. And she writes, like the hare in Aesop's fable, who believed speed alone could win a race, many in today's society, believe that there must be a quick way to lose weight and keep it off. This belief has led every year to new diets and other methods of weight loss. Unfortunately, most of these methods do not produce the desired results. In contrast, following the tortoise's approach of a slow but steady pace can lead to successful weight loss, which is maintained over time. Be realistic. It probably took years to gain the weight, so don't expect to lose it rapidly. This next expert is Alice Lichtenstein, DSC, and the executive editor of Tufts Health and Nutrition Letter. She's a senior scientist and director of the Cardiovascular Nutrition Laboratory at the HNRCA. Dr. Lichtenstein has been involved in the development of many dietary recommendations, including vice chairing the 2015 to 2020 Dietary Guidelines for Americans Committee. And she writes, successful weight loss and maintenance depend on making behavior changes that develop into new habits. Start by identifying a small number of modifiable behaviors, and then configure your environment to support those changes. For example, if you decide to cut down on certain foods or beverages, don't have them available in the house. Restock the shelves, fridge, and freezer, and rework your shopping list to emphasize the high-quality foods you have decided to include in your healthy dietary pattern. It's okay to identify a few foods that you really enjoy, and at appropriate times and in appropriate portions, enjoy them guilt-free. Purchase particularly tempting foods in portions packs, such as small squares of dark chocolate, or divide them out into single servings when they enter the house and keep them out of sight. Reaching for one should be a conscious rather than passive decision. When your initial changes begin to feel natural, move on to your next small achievable goal. And this last one is Joel B. Mason, MD. He's a senior scientist and leader of the vitamins and carcinogenesis team at the HNRCA. He studies how obesity and other factors alter the risk of cancer formation. And he writes, Understanding the true health impact of excess weight can be motivating. My expertise provides insight into one of the very important adverse health outcomes of being obese, the risk of cancer. There is now compelling evidence that obesity, and to a larger degree, being overweight, increases the risk of developing over 10 types of cancer, and the enhancement of risk is quite substantial for several of these cancers. Obesity increases the risk of developing cancers of the kidney, liver, and uterus as much as 2 to 4-fold, for example. So although I cannot advise with authority about the best way to lose weight, I can with confidence underscore the importance of losing weight and keeping it off. And here's a sidebar, take charge. Here's a list of science-backed tips and tricks for healthy, lasting weight loss from our experts. Number one, have a plan. Decide what dietary and behavior changes make the most sense for you and set realistic, achievable, time-bound goals to move forwards towards those changes. Number two, don't bite off more than you can chew. Make small changes in behavior which fit in within your lifestyle and can be maintained over time. Make one change at a time. When that one goal is reached, set another. Number three, take it slow. Gradual weight loss is a key to long-term success. Aim to lose about 0.5 to 1 pound a week. Rapid, massive weight loss should not be the goal. Number four, be mindful. Notice what you are eating and how much, but also where, when, and why. For example, eating at night, mindlessly munching in front of the TV, eating in response to stress, sadness, or loneliness, and address the factors that influence your eating behaviors. Number five, don't drink your calories. Sugary beverages are bad for health and simply add extra calories to your diet, which leads to unwanted weight gain. Number seven, cook at home. Prepare food at home as much as possible rather than ordering out. Preparing food at home gives you more control over what and how much food you plan to put in your body. Number eight, set yourself up for success. Stock the pantry, fridge, and freezer with healthy choices. Use smaller plates and glasses. Pre-portion higher calorie items. And number nine, get rid of guilt. Eating is one of life's pleasures. Don't beat yourself up for a bad day. Just go back to reaching for your goals. Eat your favorite treats occasionally in reasonable amounts and work to establish a positive relationship with food. This next article is called, in the News Bites column, Replace Some Red Meats with Protein-Containing Plant Foods to Lower Heart Disease Risk. A study recently published in the BMJ found that eating either processed or unprocessed red meat was associated with higher risk of heart disease in American men. The good news is, one serving a day of healthy protein-containing plant foods was associated with lower risk of heart disease compared with red meat. The benefit of swapping out some red meat in favor of plant foods was highest in men over 65. Unprocessed red meat includes fresh beef, pork, lamb, and venison that is not preserved in any way. Processed red meat includes foods like deli meats, bacon, ham, sausage, and jerky. Protein-containing plant foods includes beans, lentils, nuts, soy products, and some quinoa or other whole grains. To add these to your repertoire, try cutting some or all of the meats in soups, salads, stews, chilies, casseroles, tacos, and burritos, and replacing them with beans or chopped mushrooms, or munching a handful of nuts in place of jerky. Skip the breakfast meats in favor of a side of yogurt, cottage cheese, or oatmeal. Don't be afraid to experiment with soy products like tofu and edamame, or sweet fresh green soybeans if they're available in or out of the edible pod in the frozen sections of many markets. This next news bite, age is not a barrier to weight loss. A study published recently in the journal Clinical Endocrinology put to rest the idea that we can't lose weight once we've passed a certain age. A group of randomly selected individuals with obesity attending a hospital-based weight loss program were given dietary and psychological support to make lifestyle changes. In the end, those age 60 and older lost a similar amount of weight as those younger than 60 years old. Both age groups lost around 7% of their body weight. Notably, losing at least 5% of body weight has been shown to have significant health benefits. This study adds to a convincing body of evidence showing it is never too late to take charge of your health. And one more news bite, get moving to help combat depression and anxiety. As the world copes with social isolation and fear created by the COVID-19 pandemic, depression and anxiety are on the rise. A new study suggests we may feel better if we are more physically fit. An analysis of data from over 150,000 participants found that better cardiorespiratory health and stronger grip strength at baseline were both associated with lower risk for depression and/or anxiety during 7 years of follow-up. Cardiorespiratory health can be improved by increasing aerobic activity like walking, jogging, biking, rigorous housework, or dancing to your favorite tunes in your living room. Muscle strength can be increased by resistance activities, which include lifting weights or water jugs or canned goods, but also working against one's own body weight, as with push-ups, planks, and squats. If you are generally inactive or have physical limitations, online yoga or Tai Chi classes for beginners are a good place to start. Whatever your activity level, finding a way to step it up a notch is good for your health, both physical and mental. And always talk to your healthcare provider before starting any new physical activity program, and never hesitate to seek help if you think you may be suffering with depression or anxiety. And moving on now to our next publication. This is from Consumer Reports on Health. And we'll start with the Consumer Reports in Action and HealthWire. The first article, Important Mask News. What to do to bolster protection right now? Wondering how protective your cloth face mask covering is against the coronavirus? In February, the first standards for such barrier face coverings worn by the general public and workers outside of healthcare were published. They were created through ASTM International, which develops voluntary performance standards for consumer products. Face coverings that pass tests by independent third-party labs can note on labeling that they're ASTM certified. At level 1, they filter out at least 20% of particles smaller than a micron, roughly the size of respiratory droplets that generally carry the coronavirus, or at level 2, where they filter out at least 50%. N95 respirators, by comparison, filter out at least 95% of 0.3 micron particles. It's unclear how fast we'll see widespread sales of these face coverings. To improve the effectiveness of what you're currently using, here are some tips. Number 1, wear products with multiple layers and the densest possible weave. They should also have a sturdy nose wire to help help them fit your facial contours. Number 2, check for a snug seal around the nose and mouth. Ultimately, you want the air you inhale and exhale to go through some sort of filtration device, says James Dickerson, PhD, Consumer Reports Chief Scientific Officer. If your breath goes in and out the sides, you might as well not be wearing a mask, he says. Number 3, tighten a loose fit. Tying or knotting ear loops or fastening them with a claw-type hair clip behind the head or tucking in the side pleats significantly improved a surgical mask's filtration rates in one study. And the last one, double up. A surgical mask underneath a cloth one with a high weave density is more protective than either one alone. And for the HealthWire, quick tips for living well. Eat to deter Parkinson's. A Mediterranean-style diet was associated with a later onset of Parkinson's disease in a recent study of 167 people with the disorder and 119 without it. The women who most closely followed a diet featuring leafy greens, poultry, and berries developed the condition 17.4 years later than others. For men, it was 8.4 years later. The researchers say compounds in the diet are linked to reduced disease progression. The next one, skip this for chronic pain. Though antidepressants are often prescribed for chronic pain, they may be largely ineffective for it. An analysis of 33 studies found that serotonin and noradrenaline reuptake inhibitors and tricyclic antidepressants had only a small effect on back pain, sciatica, and osteoarthritis pain. If you have chronic pain, the researchers advise discussing the pros and cons of antidepressants for pain before use. And here's another quick tip. Brain benefits of napping. A regular afternoon nap was associated with better language use and memory in a recent study of 2,214 older adults. Participants reported whether or not they usually napped and took thinking and memory tests. The researchers said that napping can have downsides if it replaces physical activity and socializing. Get a vaccine through a patient portal. The 45% of older adults who don't use their primary care doctor's portal may be missing out on an easy way to sign up for the COVID-19 vaccine, according to a poll of more than 2,000 seniors. So ask your doctor whether your health system is using a patient portal for this purpose. And here's an easy blood pressure fix. After doing a stretching routine regularly for 8 weeks, older adults saw their blood pressure drop by as much as 7 points in a study of 40 people. Participants who took brisk walks daily saw smaller benefits. Both groups did their routines for 30 minutes, 5 days a week. The researchers say walking and other exercises remain important for heart health, but stretching seems to have unique benefits for blood pressure. And the last tip, asthma-safe cleaning tips. The percentage of people who reported household use of disinfectants 5 or more times a week while cleaning has almost doubled since the start of the pandemic, according to a survey of 795 adults with asthma. That frequent usage is linked to 37 to 69% greater odds for uncontrolled asthma. In the survey, disinfectant wipes and liquids were the biggest offenders, but all the disinfectants examined, including bleach, may worsen asthma. If you have asthma, consider a safer alternative, such as vinegar, water, and a drop of dish detergent. Follow label directions, open doors and windows, and turn on exhaust fans if you must use a disinfectant. And we have time for some of the Ask the Experts questions that are sent in. The first question is, can I rely on the results of an at-home test for COVID-19? And here's the answer. It's probably best to alert your doctor if you suspect you have COVID-19. The accuracy of home tests can be close to 90% in ideal conditions, but tests done by medical personnel and analyzed in a lab are more accurate, says Susan Furman, MD, vice chair of the College of American Pathologists Point of Care Testing Research Committee. And most home tests were studied in people with COVID-19 symptoms, which makes it harder to tell how they will work on asymptomatic patients, says Valerie Fitzhugh, MD, Associate Professor of Pathology, Immunology, and Laboratory Medicine at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Jersey. And the next question, I walk more slowly than I did in the past. How can I speed up? And here's the answer. If you're slowing down just a bit and are otherwise healthy, walking regularly and doing strength-building exercises like wall push-ups could help quicken your pace. But if you're concerned, consult your doctor who can check for medical issues that may contribute, says Jennifer Brack, PhD, PT, a professor in the Department of Physical Therapy in the University of Pittsburgh, who studies walking in older people. A physical therapist can also evaluate the way you walk and create an exercise program to help, she says. You may need help with balance and the timing and coordination of movements. And here's the next one. My husband struggled to hear adequately before the COVID-19 pandemic. Now his problems are significantly worse with masks and distancing. What can he do to improve his hearing issues? And here's the answer. Changes related to the COVID-19 pandemic have caused major new challenges for people who are hard of hearing or deaf, which is about 40% of those in their 60s and a greater percentage of people 70 and older. Face masks muffle sound, and cloth face masks make it impossible to read lips or see full facial expressions. Social distancing guidelines have doubled or tripled the usual distance for conversations. Online chats for work or socializing may have poor sound quality. Further, face mask ear loops might get tangled with hearing aids. To navigate these challenges, it helps to be proactive, whether dealing with a grocery store clerk or doctor or friends. Let others know your hearing is compromised before engaging in conversation. Talk with an audiologist about adding a feature to hearing aids that amplifies voices muffled by face masks. Always directly face the person you're conversing with at a safe distance. Ask friends and loved ones to consider buying either masks with clear coverings over the mouth or face shields, which allow for lip reading and seeing facial expressions. Masks with ties or straps around the back of the head can help reduce entanglement with hearing aids. In online and phone settings, reduce background noises such as a dishwasher, a TV, or fans, and close doors to muffle sound from adjacent rooms. Noise-canceling headphones designed for online conversations also can help. Ask the person on the other side of the conversation to reduce background noise as well. Consider using speech detection technology that transcribes people's words as they speak. Some smartphone apps will do this at little or no cost, although they're generally not completely accurate. Finally, consider getting your hearing tested by an audiologist and talk through strategies to improve it on a regular basis. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. This has been Leslie with Independent Living, and I hope you've enjoyed today's readings from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Able Living, followed by the Women's Hour at 11.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
The Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 Mockingbird Lane, is offering curbside adoptions, vaccines, wormer, and more. Shelter hours are from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Only one person is allowed in the office and kennels at this time. For applications, vaccine, or additional information, call 381-5503 or 257-4311 or email shelter@odessahumanesociety.org. To see current pets available or to private message the shelter, visit www.facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa.
For 10 weeks, Recording Library of West Texas Radio has presented movies from the past 90 years that won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Some of the finest dramas and performances ever put onto the screen. Now, Recording Library of West Texas Radio is bringing you one of the most acclaimed movies of all time.
Have you ever seen a grown man naked?
Airplane!
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
What kind of plane is it?
Oh, it's a big, pretty white plane with red stripes, curtains in the window, and wheels, and it looks like a big Tylenol.
Stand by for the most extraordinary chain of events ever swept up into high adventure.
I got a telegram from headquarters today.
Headquarters? What is it?
Well, it's a big building where generals meet, but that's not important right now.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking.
Airplane is drama.
I want the best available man in this. The man who knows that plane inside and out and won't crack under pressure.
How about Mr. Rogers?
I think I will have another cup of coffee.
Jim never has a second cup of coffee at home.
Airplane is action.
Stryker, that plane can't land itself. It takes a pilot who can handle pressure.
He's on, Rex. He hasn't flown for years. It's not his fault. It could happen to any pilot.
It happened to Barbara Stanwyck.
This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now.
Airplane is romance.
Excuse me. I happened to be passing. I thought you might like some coffee.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you. I want you to sit down.
Thank you. Cream?
No, thank you. I take it black. Like my man.
Never has the screen been so big.
Flight 209er, you are cleared for takeoff.
Roger.
Huh?
Flight 209er, clear for vector 324.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Peter Graves.
Joey, you like movies about gladiators.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Wait a minute. I know you. You're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You play basketball for the Los Angeles Lakers.
I'm sorry, son, but you must have me confused with someone else. My name is Roger Murdoch.
I'm the co-pilot.
I think you're the greatest, but my dad says you don't work hard enough on defense. And that you don't really try, except during the playoffs.
The hell I don't. I've been hearing that crap ever since I was at UCLA. I'm out there busting my buns every night. Tell your old man to drag Walton and Lanier up and down the court for 48 minutes.
Leslie Nielsen.
What was it we had for dinner tonight?
Well, we had a choice, steak, fish.
Yes, yes, I remember. I had lasagna.
Lloyd Bridges.
Picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
Robert Stack.
All right, I'll need 3 men up on the tower.
The tower? Rapunzel! Rapunzel!
Julie Haggerty.
By the way, is there anyone on board who knows how to fly a plane?
The most incredible adventure the screen has ever created.
Passengers certain to die. Airline negligent.
There's a sale at Penny's.
Joey, have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Johnny, what can you make out of this?
This? Well, I could make a cap, or a brooch, a pterodactyl.
The big news is Airplane.
While many of the gags are sight-driven, Airplane will be fully audio-described. So get ready for some laughs this weekend with Airplane, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
I just want to tell you both good luck. We're all counting on you.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 56 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome, this is Able Living, and I'm your reader Kevin with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Disability Scoop, and now I'll begin with Marijuana-themed license plates to benefit disability community, this article written by Sean Heasley. In an effort to better support people with disabilities, one state is offering motorists the chance to emblazon their cars with phrases like bong, ganja, hash, and hemp. Colorado is auctioning off 14 official state license plates with cannabis-themed phrases. Money raised will go to the Colorado Disability Funding Committee and will be used to fund disability application assistance as well as new and innovative programs increasing quality of life and independence of Colorado's disability community, according to Governor Jared Polis's office. The Colorado Disability Funding Committee was created in 2016 to support organizations benefiting the disability community. The group has the authority to sell license plate configurations in the state. Other phrases that have been auctioned in the past include It's Fast, Rocket, and McLaren. So far, ISIT420 is the phrase garnering the most interest in the current auction, with bids topping $6,600. In other words, ISIT420 being Is It 420. Colorado is proud of our creativity and ingenuity, Paulus said. We've been a leader in the cannabis space for over a decade, and this effort allows us to fund critical projects and programs in our disability community. The auction winners will have the rights to use the specified combination of letters and numbers on their Colorado license plate. The online auction is ended. It was on April the 20th. Our next article, written by Christy Karras of the Los Angeles Times, entitled Temple Grandin Champions Different Kinds of Minds on PBS. A special episode of PBS Xavier Riddle and the Secret Museum hinges on the principle that sometimes people think and do things differently, and that's okay. But Temple Grandin knows firsthand that varying modes of thought are more than just okay. They're essential to human progress. If you get the right teams of people to do things that have complementary skills, it can really, really make for great things getting done. The animal welfare scientist, author, and autism activist told the Los Angeles Times on a recent video call from her home in Fort Collins, Colorado. We need the different kinds of minds. Often educators concentrate too much on the area of deficit and not enough on the area of skill. Multiple PBS series are celebrating Autism Awareness Month in April by spotlighting new characters with autism, including one based on Grandin. The 73-year-old professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University appears as a child in the aforementioned episode of Xavier Riddle and the Secret Museum, which premiered recently and is available to stream in full on PBS Kids' YouTube channel. Additional reruns of the I Am Temple Grandin episode are slated to air April 22nd on all PBS stations and again April 30th, May 1st, and May 2nd on PBS Kids. I Am Temple Grandin sees its principal trio of curious kids, Xavier, Yadina, and Brad, time travel through their secret museum portal to visit a younger version of the titular scholar in 1953 Massachusetts. There, a cartoon Grandin, voiced by Sarah Ralph, teaches her guests that sometimes people think and do things differently by showing them there is more than one way to fly a kite. While Xavier, Yadina, and Brad stand still and watch their kites float directly above them, Grandin attaches her homemade bird kite to her bicycle. The other children look on and in awe as Grandin's kite glides through the air in her wake, a soaring testament to the creative power of divergent minds. I like the fact that it highlighted that I like kites, Grandin told the Los Angeles Times after viewing the episode. I was very good with kites. Liking kites is something that's a positive thing. I used to spend hours tinkering with different kinds of kites to get them to work. A lot of kids today are growing up, and they don't tinker with things anymore. They're too afraid to make a mistake. In a conversation edited for length and clarity, the Los Angeles Times spoke with Grandin about her appearance in the Xavier Riddle and the Secret Museum and the importance of autism representation in children's programming. Question: how did the idea for this episode come about, and how did you get involved? PBS just approached me. That's how I got involved. And I watched the episode. It's really cute, and I think it's going to be very good for helping out the kids to understand other kids might be autistic. One thing that was good for me when I was in elementary school is that my teacher explained to the other children that I had a disability, but it wasn't visible like a wheelchair, and they needed to be helping me. So I managed to get through elementary school without being bullied. High school was a nightmare of bullying. I had no speech until I was four. I had all the classic symptoms of autism, but I thought they did a nice job with that episode. Question: how closely did you work with PBS to develop the storyline? Temple Grandin says, I had a few phone calls with them. Actually, when they did the HBO movie on me, 2010's Temple Grandin starring Claire Danes, I had a lot more input, working with the writers and producers. PBS had access to many, many talks I had online, but I did really like the way that they showed it. Question: what was it like to see yourself as a cartoon? Temple Grandin: it had gray hair on it, which I was kind of surprised to see as I had my Western shirts on, but I think it's a really good thing to be showing to kids because one of the things I like a lot of people have a hard time understanding is sensory problems. That a sound doesn't bother you, like maybe the sound of school bells going off, for example, might just be like a dentist drill hitting a nerve to a kid with autism, or they might have problems with certain kinds of lighting. It's too bright or it flickers. The sensory issues are extremely variable. Question: what is the significance of seeing people with autism represented in children's programming? Temple Grandin says, it's important because it's showing that people with autism are part of the world, of humanity, and we wouldn't even have these computers and Zoom and things like that we're talking on now without some people with autism. It's sort of similar to having the Paralympics. I was really happy to see that happening in the same venue as the regular Olympics, and wheelchair basketball is a pretty cool thing to watch. And it's becoming normal, and that's good. Question: what do you hope parents and kids take away from your story as depicted in the episode? Temple Grandin says, one thing is to teach kids to treat others that are different nicely, too. It's important to teach kids to be tolerant and kind, and my elementary school teacher doing so made it possible for me to have a very nice, pretty much good elementary school experience and not be bullied. But there's other kids right now in elementary school that may be autistic or maybe they have some other issue and they're getting bullied in elementary. I have to thank my teacher for doing what's now called peer-mediated intervention, and that helped the other kids be a lot nicer to me. What can typically developing people do to support the autism community during Autism Awareness Month? And Temple says, be aware of some of the sensory issues. I can't multitask. I would show people my drawings and they'd go, oh, maybe you're weird, but then they'd hire me. I learned how to sell my work. I'd sell my work, not myself. And that's why it's so important to develop his skills. You might have another kid that's good at math. Well, then introduce them to programming. My mind thinks in photorealistic pictures right now. I'm working on a book on visual thinking, and I'm working with my fabulous, totally verbal thinker and editor, Betsy. And I look at how she rearranges my stuff. She's like magic, how she does this. But then the things I write, she wouldn't be able to do. See, that's where it's different. It's different minds working together. The next story, written by Michelle DeMint, and it is called New Push Underway to Eliminate Sub-Minimum Wage. Government investigators say that a lack of resources is one of the main reasons people with disabilities continue to work for less than minimum wage. Now some lawmakers want to change that. A bipartisan bill introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives this month would phase out what's known as subminimum wage over 5 years and provide the means to support people with disabilities in the transition to competitive, integrated employment. The legislation introduced by Representatives Bobby Scott, Democrat of Virginia, and Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican of Washington, seeks to do away with a federal provision dating back to 1938 that allows employers to obtain special 14C certificates from the Department of Labor, authorizing them to pay people with disabilities less than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. More than 30 years after the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, our nation's permanent wage and hour law still denies equal opportunity for far too many workers with disabilities. It is long past time for Congress to phase out the subminimum wage for workers with disabilities and expand access to fulfilling employment and economic self-sufficiency, Scott said. The measure, known as Transformation of Competitive Integrated Employment Act, H.R. 2373, would halt the issuance of any new 14C certificates immediately and require that employees working under existing certificates be paid at least minimum wage within 5 years. The legislation would also create grant programs to help 14C certificate holders transition to supporting workers with disabilities in competitive, integrated employment. And the lawmakers said their proposal provides for the inclusive wraparound services that some individuals with disabilities will need when subminimum wages are phased out. The bill introduction comes on the heels of a Government Accountability Office report detailing the barriers that people with disabilities face in moving away from subminimum wage work. The report, which is based on a research review and interviews with experts and officials across 5 states, identifies 32 factors that help or hinder the transition from subminimum wage jobs to competitive integrated employment. Among the issues cited are family concerns about individuals maintaining their federal benefits, the level of resources to help 14C certificate holders provide services like job coaching to support competitive employment, state policies, and local factors like the availability of transportation. As of October 20th, 1,247 employers had obtained or applied for 14C certificates, according to the GAO, and little is known about the extent to which individuals have successfully transitioned to competitive employment. The situation has been further muddied by COVID-19 pandemic, which forced many work sites, including those paying subminimum wage, to close, investigators said in their findings. In addition to the Transformation to Competitive Integrated Employment Act, there are a number of other legislative efforts in the works that would put an end to subminimum wage. Phasing out the practice is among the goals of the Raise the Wage Act, a bill chiefly aimed at increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour. And President Joe Biden is currently pushing an infrastructure package called the American Jobs Plan that also seeks to do away with subminimum wage. Several states and cities from Maryland to Alaska have already moved to prohibit employers from paying people with disabilities less than the minimum wage in recent years. However, many families continue to support the option of subminimum wage employment, arguing that it offers purpose for those with more significant disabilities who may struggle in other work environments. Our next article, written by Sean Heasley, entitled Ed Department Says More Students with Disabilities Graduating. An increasing number of students with disabilities across the nation are graduating high school, according to new federal figures, but the odds of receiving a diploma vary considerably by state. The high school graduation rate for those with disabilities rose to 68.2% for the 2018-2019 school year. That's up from 67.1% the year prior. The data comes from a report issued recently by the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics and reflects the number of students who graduated within 4 years with a regular high school diploma. Despite the progress, students with disabilities continue to lag far behind their peers, the report shows, with the national graduation rate for all students growing to 85.8%. And there is significant variance by state. At the high end, the graduation rate for students with disabilities was 82.6% in Arkansas, while bottom-ranked Mississippi saw just 42.2% of those students receiving a diploma. Education Department officials note the differences in how rates are calculated may contribute to the disparities. In light of the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on special education services, some families are pushing to win an extra year of school eligibility for students with disabilities who were set to age out this spring. There is a bill currently under consideration in the New Jersey legislature to extend eligibility. Meanwhile, the New York State Education Department is asking schools and school districts in that state to offer students with disabilities who are aging out the opportunity to attend summer school and continue their education through the next school year as needed to earn their diploma or other credential. Given these young adults that have worked so hard for so long, the opportunity to complete their schooling and transition to the next step in their lives will benefit them, their families, and the communities in which they live and work. This is what they deserve, and again, we urge you to offer them this opportunity, wrote John L. Diagatti from the New York State Education Department in a memo last week to school leaders. The next story is written by Linda Roy of the Standard Times. It's called Missing Persons with Special Needs Pose Challenge for First Responders. Dateline to Fairhaven, Massachusetts. The call comes into the police department for a missing person. Sometimes it's regarding an adult who didn't show up for work. It might be a teenager who has run away from home. It might be a child who got separated from their parents while on an outing. Police train for these kinds of missing persons cases, but what happens when the missing person has special needs and may be unable to communicate with authorities? That's exactly what happened when Kenneth Parks of New Bedford wandered away from his group during a visit to Cushman Park in Fairhaven on March 17th. Parks, 73, diagnosed with autism, is nonverbal and only speaks in grunts, especially when he gets anxious, according to his caregivers. After missing for nearly 22 hours, Park was found sitting in someone's car. He was unharmed, but was taken to the hospital by ambulance for an assessment. All officers have received classroom training regarding dealing with persons with special needs, said Fairhaven Sergeant Timothy F. Souza. He said the training happens at the department's annual in-service academies or for newer officers in their initial full-time police academy. Aside from the police academy training, we have a few officers in our department who are assigned to the SEM LEC Search and Rescue Mobile Command Units. These officers are specially trained for these type of responses. The Southern Massachusetts Law Enforcement Council is a mutual aid consortium comprised of resources from the police departments of 30 cities and towns. It responds when requested by a chief of police to assist with search and rescue, special events, or major crimes. SEMLEC was activated in the search for the Parks along with Fairhaven, Acushnet, and Mattapoisett Police Departments, Fairhaven Fire Department, Fairhaven Harbor Master, New Bedford Police Department Marine Unit, Bristol County Sheriff's Office Canine Unit, SEMLEC Search and Rescue, SEMLEC Mobile Command Center, SEMLEC Dive Team, SEMLEC Bicycle Unit, Mass State Police Special Emergency Response Team, and Mass State Police Air Wing, Mass Environmental Police, and the Department of Conservation and Recreation, all those organizations being called out for the search of the 73-year-old. Parks, who lives in a residential group home, was on an outing in Cushman Park in Fairhaven when he wandered away from the group. Around 2 p.m., he was reported missing to police. An initial call was made to dispatch, and officers responded, Souza said. The shift supervisor and his team immediately flooded the area. He said officers talked to the last known person who saw Parks and then branched out into general area, stopping people and asking if they had seen him. Other police and fire assets were then brought to the scene to expand the search perimeter. In this case, initially, SEMLEC Search and Rescue was called, as well as Fairhaven, Fire, and Bristol County Sheriff Canine Units, Souza noted. Within a short period of time, we had other assets, such as the Mass State Police Air Wing Division, assisting as well. During the two-day search, we had approximately 12 to 15 different agencies involved. SEMLEC became part of the search for Mr. Parks once the unit was called by the Fairhaven Police Department, said Somerset Police Chief George McNeil, control chief for SEMLEC Search and Rescue. The call-out for search and rescue is requested by the participating municipality, usually when they've exhausted their resources, but this can change, particularly if weather conditions are poor or cold. Call-out times can also vary depending upon the missing person's age, medical condition, and other factors which may require a sooner response. McDeal said a command post was set up inside a command vehicle similar to a large mobile home that has the ability to communicate with all agencies, including the state police and its air wing. A large flat-screen TV is used to map grids of areas to be searched, starting with the location where the person was last seen. The grids get expanded as the search widens, he says. Sheriff Tom Hodgson rolled out his department's canine unit almost right away in the search. Canine Captain Paul Douglas received the initial call for assistance from Fairhaven Police and was told there was a missing senior citizen with autism, and canine support from the BCSO was being requested, wrote BCSO Information Officer Jonathan Darling on the department's social media page. The entire canine unit responded. If we can, we get information from a family member or caretaker on exactly how that person should be approached, Souza said. Every person is different. Autistic individuals are not, in general, volatile, but we need to take a careful approach toward them so as to not frighten them and doing our best to put them at ease with us. In Mr. Park's case, we had conversations with his caretaker and the people at the place he resided, McNeil said. Search and rescue always make sure that the home residence is checked thoroughly, because many times we find the missing person hiding or sleeping. This happens a lot with children. We asked his personal physician to come to our command post so we could get specifics on his behavior, McNeil said. When his doctor arrived, we asked her what she thought he may do if he was lost. It was thought that he may look for a place to sit down at some point, and we thought that place would be an open car, which is where he was ultimately found. BCSO officer Chris Vaz was a huge help in the search and rescue effort, Darling wrote. As a program manager of the BCSO's Project Lifesaver program, his extensive knowledge of the challenges and behaviors demonstrated by people with autism, he was able to share those with rescue teams. Project Lifesaver is a program through the Bristol County Sheriff's Office that offers a GPS tracking bracelet to be placed in individuals with special needs to help locate them if they wander. Project Lifesaver reports a recovery time average of less than 30 minutes. Upon resuming the search early the next morning, a woman alerted search teams that she might have found Parks. She said she found a man sitting in the back seat of her car in the driveway. It was Parks. The first officers got no response from Parks when they addressed him as Mr. Parks and then as Kenneth. However, as Darling recounted, canine Captain Paul Douglas addressed him as Kenny. When he heard Kenny, he turned and looked me right in the eye. I knew he was okay, and it was the best feeling in the world, Douglas said. It was a huge relief for all of us involved when he was located, McNeil said. You simply can't service your community unless you can serve its most vulnerable members, Hodgson said. The first lesson for each and every canine team at the BCSO is tracking and locating missing persons, and they stand by ready to assist in any public safety situation that may arise. It seemed like everyone in Fairhaven was out with flashlights, coffee, snacks, anything to help out, Darling wrote. He quotes Lieutenant Kelly Almeida, who searched with his canine Will. It's hard to put into words just how great the neighbors in the community were. They were flooding us with tips and offers to help. They were donating coffee and food and water. It was truly amazing, and it was nonstop. I felt like all the reasons why I chose a career with law enforcement, the feeling of being a part of a community and keeping it safe. There was an overwhelming feeling of relief, Souza said. In our profession, we have to, unfortunately, prepare mentally for the worst, but hope for the best. At the command post, when the announcement was made that he was found, searchers were high-fiving and thanking each other for their assistance. The situation ended, as we wish all did, a very happy ending. Our next and final story of the day, entitled Biden Seeks $400 Billion to Buttress Long-Term Care, a look at what's at stake. The article written by Judith Graham of Kaiser Health News. There is widespread agreement that it's important to help the older adults and people with disabilities remain independent for as long as possible. But are we prepared to do what's necessary as a nation to make this possible? That's the challenge President Joe Biden has put forward with his bold proposal to spend $400 billion over 8 years on home and community-based services, a major part of his $2 trillion infrastructure plan. It's a historic and profound opportunity to build a stronger framework of services surrounding vulnerable people who need considerable ongoing assistance, said Ai-Jen Poo, director of Caring Across Generations, a national group advocating for older adults, individuals with disabilities, families, and caregivers. It comes as the coronavirus pandemic has wreaked havoc in the nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and group homes, killing more than 174,000 people and triggering awareness of the need for more long-term care options. There is a much greater understanding now that it is not a good thing to be stuck in a long-term care institution, and that community-based care is an essential alternative which the vast majority of people would prefer, said Ari Neiman, senior research associate at Harvard Law School's Project on Disabilities. The systems we do have are crumbling due to the underfunding and understaffing, and there has never been a greater opportunity for change than now, said Katie Smith Sloan, president of Leading Edge, at a recent press conference where the president's proposal was discussed. Leading Edge is a national association of more than 5,000 nonprofit nursing homes, assisted living centers, senior living communities, and home care providers. But prospects for the president's proposal are uncertain. Republicans decry its cost and argue that much of what the proposed American Jobs Plan contains, including the emphasis on home-based care, doesn't count as real infrastructure. Though this proposal is a necessary step to strengthen our long-term care system, politically it'll be a challenge, suggested Joseph Gogler, a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, who studies long-term care. Even advocates acknowledge the proposal doesn't address the full extent of care needed by the nation's rapidly growing older population. In particular, middle-income seniors won't qualify directly for the programs that would be expanded. They would, however, benefit from a larger, better-paid, better-trained workforce of aides that help people in their homes, one of the plan's objectives. This plan isn't everything that's needed. Not by any step of the imagination, Pooh said. What we really want to go to is universal access to long-term care, but that will be a multi-step process. Understanding what at stake is essential as communities across the country and Congress begin discussing Biden's proposal. The services in question, home and community-based services, help people who need significant assistance live at home as opposed to nursing homes or group homes. Services can include home visits from nurses or occupational therapists, assistance with personal care such as eating or bathing, helping from case managers, and attendance at adult daily day centers, and many, many more items included in the article available through Disability Scoop. Well, it is all the time we have for today. This has been Kevin with Able Living. Hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Center's Solutions Podcast, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Aphasia Center of West Texas has scheduled a tribute to the legendary Queen and Freddie Mercury. Live and virtual options, May 7th. She's a killer queen, got that identity. We will rock you. We are the champions, my friend. At the Horseshoe Amphitheater, 2514 Arena Trail, Midland. Scholarship is available. To sponsor, make a reservation, or for more information, call 432-699-1261. All we hear is Radio Gaga, Radio Gugu. Or visit www.aphasiawtx.org/concert. Call 432-699-1261 or visit www.aphasiawtx.org/concert.
Now airing on the Noon Book Hour, The Street Lawyer by John Grisham. Michael Brock is billing the hours, making the money, rushing relentlessly to the top of Drake and Sweeney, a giant D.C. law firm. One step away from partnership, Michael has it all. Then in an instant, it all comes undone. A homeless man takes 9 lawyers hostage in the firm's plush offices. When it's all over, the man's blood is splattered on Michael's face. And suddenly, Michael is willing to do the unthinkable. Rediscovering a conscience he lost long ago, Michael is leaving the big time for the streets where his attacker once lived, and where society's powerless need an advocate for justice. But there's one break Michael can't make. From a secret that has floated up from the depths of Drake and Sweeney, from a confidential file that is now in Michael's hands, and from a conspiracy that has already taken lives. Now Michael's former partners are about to become his bitter enemies, because to them, Michael Brock is the most dangerous man on the streets. The Street Lawyer by John Grisham. Weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Tonsillectomies are a thing of the past. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a 72-year-old woman who is blessed with good health. In my adolescent years, I occasionally got strep throat, but a respected doctor of internal medicine, later head of a medical school, cautioned my mother against ever having my tonsils taken out. The general advice of the day was to have them removed, but he said that the tonsils are the first line of defense against more serious infections, that they serve to filter out bad microbes that invade the body, and a mild sore throat can be proof that the tonsils are doing their job. I wonder, when doctors or researchers are putting together their questionnaires to attempt to determine why one person has certain symptoms of a disease but not others, or why certain people are more vulnerable to an infectious disease when others aren't, is the question ever asked if the patients still have their tonsils? It strikes me as a simple question that could possibly lead to a deeper analysis of the body's defense mechanisms. S.J.W. Answer. Long-term follow-up of children who have had their tonsils removed shows approximately double the risk of developing respiratory infections in the subsequent 10 to 30 years. Removing the adenoids, typically done at the same time, increased the risk of developing chronic obstructive lung disease. As you note, far fewer of today's children have their tonsils out compared with the almost routine tonsillectomy of years ago. I agree with you that more research is called for. However, I will note that during an exam, lack of tonsils and adenoids is usually quite apparent, and enlarged tonsils certainly are. To your good health.